ChristianGeekCentral.com.
Episode 728. Warning, access restricted. Please submit to DNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome.
Hello and welcome to the Monitor Room at the Christian Geek Central Podcast, a biblical examination and celebration of geekery, good gravy, and geek entertainment, as well as the official podcast of ChristianGeekCentral.com. I'm Peter Franson from Spirit Blade Productions, producing entertainment and resources to hopefully equip, encourage, and inspire Christian geeks like you and me to live in the freedom and purpose that Christ has given us. For more information about Spirit Blade Productions, you can check out SpiritBlade.com or Patreon.com/SpiritBladeProductions. On the show today, I don't really know. I started coming down with something yesterday that just started kind of sucking the energy out of me. Our oldest has had a sore throat and a bit of a cough for the last, week or two. Been hanging on a little bit. Of course, you know, COVID is the first thing that comes to mind. But we don't have reason to think that that's what he's got. He hasn't been tested for it or anything. But anyway, I've got a little something going on, and was able, through just a lot of sleep last night, and then Holly graciously let me sleep in this morning and took the boys to school, but sleeping, going to bed early, sleeping in late, taking zinc, drinking tons of water. My throat is not, you know, hurting right now or even uncomfortable at all right now, but definitely some redness back there. And I was wondering if I was, you know, last night I was like, I wonder if I'm even going to be able to record the podcast tomorrow. But anyway, it's Thursday as I record this, and I'm feeling pretty good, but I'm a little bit sleepy or drowsy or foggy, and I think that's probably just because of the extra amounts of Benadryl that I've taken in the last 24 hours, but I ultimately don't know. So I'm not sure what the main content of this episode will be. I'll have to check the descriptions, the timestamps. I am going to be talking a little bit about Potion Permit in the Geek Week segment. This is a indie video game that I had intended to review and make a review for the channel as well, but I downgraded it to just sharing a few thoughts in this episode in the Geek Week segment because of being sick and sleeping extra. I took a nap yesterday in addition to going to bed early last night, and then slept in a bunch this morning. So it's been, of course, cutting into my work day the last 2 days. And I took some notes and I have some thoughts to share. But also, I think that in this episode, it's likely to be Black Adam and/or the series premiere of Peripheral on Amazon Prime. That's what I'm going for anyway. We'll see. If you don't see it actually in the timestamps or the description, you can probably count on both of those being on the show next week. Also on this episode, I've already recorded this, but I'll share some thoughts about pointless self-discipline versus a transformed heart as we can continue our study of the book of Colossians. Plus, in the Geek Week segment, as I've already mentioned, in addition to that, Parasite. I saw the movie Parasite this week, which was considered a horror movie when it was being promoted. I don't think it's a horror movie. I'll share my thoughts on why. And then in addition, in the video game section of Geek Week, in addition to Potion Permit, I'll talk about Scorn a bit. I played a little bit of Scorn. Ayuden Chronicle Rising, which has been out for a little while now. And some unexpected value that I am discovering with Game Pass. Those of you that have listened to or watched my content for a while know that I personally don't find Game Pass to be worth it for me, Peter Franson, to pay for month to month. I'm not saying that it doesn't have great value for many, many other people, but for me, it doesn't. However, I got it this month to do a... I was intending to do a review of Scorn, ended up not doing that. but wanted to still leverage it for content creation and just kind of, you know, share what I could that could be useful to you guys. And so in going through Game Pass and seeing what they had there, I discovered some value of a very specific kind that I'll look forward to sharing with you guys near the end of the show. I've also, again, finished my time with Baldur's Gate on PlayStation 4. I thought I had already, but I got back into it again. But now I think for realsies, I'm done. Maybe for a number of years at this point, we'll see. And then in tabletop gaming, I don't always talk about tabletop gaming every week, but Four Against Darkness has been on my mind. Been playing that again, and I'm going to compare that a bit to Pathfinder: The Adventure Card Game, and then also talk briefly about the possibility of converting D&D modules to Four Against Darkness. And anyway, so a number of things going on in the Geek Week segment, even if there's no review content at all in the rest of the show, we'll see. Again, you can check the timestamps for more details. And there is definitely also going to be topics based on your questions, comments, and feedback. So, yeah, again, timestamps, here we go. My father once told me that I could use my powers to make a difference. He told me I had a responsibility to help others. He told me I could save this world, save everyone. Then he told me, walk the gerbil, walk the gerbil. Frickin' weirdo. Black Adam. The synopsis on IMDb reads, nearly 5,000 years after he was bestowed with the almighty powers of the Egyptian gods and imprisoned just as quickly, Black Adam is freed from his earthly tomb, ready to unleash his unique form of justice on the modern world. Okay, so stay tuned. At the end of this video, I'll make some closing stuff and my usual plugs, and then I'll have a spoiler section at the end. I might put a timestamp in the video version as well. If you're listening to this on the podcast, I'll put my spoiler thoughts all the way after the end credits of the entire podcast. For now, what the crap happened? Maybe there were some indications in the credits as they rolled at the end. I saw three writers being credited and two editors. I'm not sure how common two editors is. I think I'm used to seeing mainly one, and three writers, that's not certainly unheard of and not like as outlandish as I think the five that the Ryan Reynolds Green Lantern movie had, but three is still, that's splitting the focus. It's certainly not one creative vision from beginning to end on that project to have three writers. And add to that what I just watched, and it makes me think that this production might have been really troubled. The bottom line is that it felt rushed and unfocused to me. The dialogue often felt like it was mainly serving exposition and just trying to get us from, you know, the main information that we need to go from A to B. Or it was filled with cliche movie talk that doesn't feel real. It just feels like, oh yeah, this is the kind of copy and paste dialogue that you hear in a lot of different movies. It doesn't really sound like real people talking. And characters would also sometimes say things that felt unwarranted and unjustified given what had happened in the movie up to that point and their knowledge up to that point or their relationship to characters up to that point. Sometimes leaping forward in comfort level or like this thing you're saying to him, that's something you say after you address the fact that he just crashed through your wall or whatever. It's like how are you going straight to that? There's that lack of psychological grounding, or what I sometimes call faux psychological realism, which there's a lot of that going on in the Marvel movies where they'll kind of give nods now and then to how people would really react in these kinds of situations, but they're still not fully engaged in the psychology of how people would much more likely react, namely being traumatized, freaked out, very troubled by their circumstances. And a lot of it is just kind of taken in stride, and that really pulls the rug out from under any sources of tension for me. And also, they sacrifice at times character logic and character consistency for the sake of going for a joke instead. You know, one example would be that Black Adam is a character. He's been asleep basically for 5,000 years. When he wakes up, everything is very alien to him. Even mirrors, let alone televisions, are entirely alien to him. But then, as the movie progresses, now and then he'll say these things, and I'm like, well, that sounds like something The Rock would say. Doesn't quite sound like, you know, I mean, it doesn't really sound like something that this character who's been asleep for 5,000 years would say. It sounds just a little anachronistic, just a little bit in the realm of modern casual talk, you know. Now, I love DC Comics. I so wanted more from this experience and would really be interested in a director's alternate cut if it exists. And I think that's a possibility given the nature of the production, three writers, two editors. I also love the Justice Society. I'm a big fan of what Geoff Johns did to revitalize them back in the, I guess, late 90s, early 2000s. But they are thrown in here and given almost equal focus with Black Adam, which I'm like, I love the Justice Society. This needs to be Black Adam's story. We need to get into his character and his motivations, and too much time is taken away from those possibilities, those opportunities, in favor of giving time to the Justice Society, which also doesn't get the time that it needs, not near enough to establish itself. So it's like a tale of two movies being crammed together into one here. And not only that, but the Justice Society itself only has a token representation of its roster. That's understandable. You don't want to have the Jay Garrick Flash in there until you've established Barry Allen. You probably don't want to have Alan Scott Green Lantern until Hal Jordan has had his movie, you know? So I understand why some of these choices might have been made, but oh my gosh, wouldn't it be cool to see a Gal Gadot, like a Justice Society movie with Gal Gadot in it? Maybe she came out of hiding for just a little bit to be a part of a Justice Society. Wouldn't that be a cool movie, you know? Anyway, this is far from the Justice Society in its full glory with its most well-known characters. Although, I really appreciated Dr. Fate. I enjoy that character. I love the design of his costume. I should have put that in my notes when I talk about visual stuff. I love the visual design and the kind of the movieization of his costume in this. Really great stuff. And he gets a lot of great moments in terms of action scenes and how his powers come into play and stuff. Very cool. But, you know, what the crap is going on? Who in the world is the Justice Society? Where have they been? They call themselves the Justice Society, and I know I'm a huge comic book fan for decades, but just in the context of the DC movie universe, I'm like, what do you mean you're the Justice Society? What the crap is a Justice Society? Where have they been? They're acting like they've been around for a long time. They're super well-funded. Hawkman's got a jet that comes out of his mansion grounds, like the X-Men jet. And I'm like, who the crap is Hawkman? It just says on the screen, Hawkman's mansion. Who the crap is Hawkman? You say that like I'm supposed to know who Hawkman is. And then Amanda Waller's in the mix. They're kind of, I don't know, reporting to Amanda Waller, who I know is the woman who heads up Task Force X, the Suicide Squad. What's her connection here? Was there a little tease at the end of the most recent Suicide Squad movie that maybe she was cooking up another team or something? I don't know. I don't remember. But there was just so much here that was unestablished that I was just begging to have established and explained in this continuity. Who the crap is Hawkman? Who is Cyclone? Who is Atom Smasher or Dr. Fate? You know, we get bare bones answers for Cyclone and how she got her powers, but almost nothing for others in terms of their origins and motivations. There's a sweet moment with Atom Smasher talking to the original. He said that he got his costume from the original Atom Smasher. In the comics, that's not quite accurate. He got his name from the original, the Atom. Not the shrinking guy, but the World War II guy who was just a short boxer, you know, with a really powerful punch, you know. So they're kind of like, you know, riffing on his origin from the comics a little bit there. But I like that sense of legacy. But that was all we got, was a brief conversation with his uncle Al Pratt, the original Atom Smasher. And we don't know where this Atom Smasher got the ability to grow really huge or what his limits are, whatever. It's a huge shame because, especially when I think about Hawkman and Dr. Fate, their origins are deeply connected to ancient Egypt, which is so adjacent to Kandak or however you say it, and Black Adam, that I'm stunned that they didn't leverage that to create a story that would better connect these characters, better establish their origins and motivations, you know, in connection to each other. It's just, oh my gosh, why in the world would you not do that? Same with Intergang as the primary antagonist for most of the movie. Who the crap is Intergang? Now, I know who Intergang is, DC Comics nerd here, but like, with my movie head on, I'm like, who the crap is Intergang? What do they ultimately want? What is an Intergang? Is it a terrorist organization or just like a big, really well-funded gang? Because they are crazy well-funded and organized with installations that are billions of dollars of money's worth put into technology and hidden bases and stuff. And I'm like, what the crap is this? What the crap is going on? But, you know, if you don't care about story and character much and you just want a shallow special effects bonanza, Black Adam will deliver, and I don't fault anybody who just wants that and is going to be content with that. That's not where I'm at. I want a whole lot more than that, and I just didn't feel like the stakes of all of that action that is plentiful throughout the movie were really hitting home for me because of the near constant jokiness that seems, again,
mystifyingly, to be chasing after some kind of Marvel wannabe flavor. And without better establishing the origins of characters, it's hard to know, you know, what their limits are in terms of their powers and when they are pushing themselves to their limits. You know, when the hero pushes themselves to their limits and you sense that it's costing them something, you feel that with them, but we don't really know what the boundaries are for these characters and their powers because there's been almost no time spent establishing who they are and what they can do. And combine that with all the jokes, and it just made the action moments weightless for me. As far as the cast goes, I really did think that the actors were all solid and fitting for their roles here. However, the ADR, which is the post-production voice recording that actors will come in and do to make up for the fact that sometimes when they're shooting on a set or like a public space, there's other sounds going on that would mess up the recording, you know, actually on the day, so they come in after the fact to record their lines. And so if you've ever noticed that, like, weirdly in a movie, a line seems dubbed or it doesn't quite match the actor's performance or what's going on there, that's, you know, that's just an example of kind of bad ADR that doesn't quite fit the moment. And frequently the ADR felt way off to me. No. Let me scale that back. I'm getting a little bit too hyperbolic here. Recurringly, it felt way off at times. And that just made the movie seem like something all the more disjointed and thrown together, making me wonder how much rewriting was done, maybe in post-production, which would maybe explain this ADR that just doesn't seem like it was given the time it needed. So director's cut, please, if it exists out there, you know, maybe I wouldn't like it any more than this, but I have to think that at least it would be a more cohesive vision that I could better try to appreciate. Even Dwayne Johnson, though, not known for his acting ability, I think fit well in Black Adam's stoic moments, and he gave a great performance in some brief flashbacks related to his tragic backstory, so I definitely have to tip my hat to him for that. By the way, though, that tragic backstory is treated as a revelation in this movie, even though it's information that was presented in, I think, multiple trailers for this movie. I'm like, what? Why would you put that in the trailer? If you're going to wait till the back end of the movie to establish his origin and what's really driving him. That was another problem, you know? It's like they didn't... I knew from the trailers and from the comics the basics of, you know, that he had a tragic backstory that made him driven by revenge and all that kind of stuff. But without them actually stating that or making that clear at the beginning, His motives, you know, were unclear, and so all the possibility for moral ambiguity and tension in terms of that kind of thing, it just wasn't present like I think it could have been. As far as stunts and visuals go, I have to say this, I really liked the visual presentation. It has a brown-tinted, high-contrast look that's very in keeping, I think, with Snyder's movies and at least his visual color palette, and it even employs slow motion to great effect, especially in this opening scene where he's just really cutting loose as the military or gang or whoever is really trying to take him down. And the slow motion and the various effects just really showcase how effortlessly and casually powerful and destructive Black Adam is compared to those who try to go up against him. So really appreciated the visual look and the visual style, both in action moments and in non-action moments. I liked the look of this movie. Now, by no means is it perfect or really pushing the bar higher in terms of visual effects, but it has a quality and style that I love as a Snyder fan. And it just really makes me wish that it had a different script connecting all these cool visual moments together. Now, as far as themes, is there anything of moral, philosophical, or spiritual significance in the themes of this thing that might trigger some worthwhile thought or conversation? I don't know. I tend not to see themes. Sorry, I'm rushed. I know. It's because my voice is going to give out on me because I'm sick, and I got to pick up my son in just a few minutes here. So I'm sorry I'm speeding through this. But I don't tend to see themes as easily in content that I don't enjoy. Maybe there's something here about justice versus revenge or something. Black Adam is such an interestingly motivated character in the comics, and that does carry over through to here, but there's so much potential there that the movie doesn't focus enough to truly take advantage of. So I don't think it's a movie that's really going to be likely to make people be thinking about worthwhile things. As far as, I have no idea what your tastes are in movies, but if I were a time traveler, go back in time, say, skip. Buy this in a bargain bin when it's under $10 if something comes along that this movie serves as a precursor to, such as, you know, a JSA movie or another Black Adam movie that looks like it's going to be a more enjoyable experience to you than this one. Sadly, this one is nothing you're really going to enjoy that much. It's rated PG-13 for sequences of strong violence, intense action, and some language. And apart from my spoiler thoughts in just a little bit, those are all my thoughts for now on Black Adam.
Data collection complete. Activating MusicNet 1.0.
Well, let me start things out here by playing you some audio of an update video I put up this week regarding Game Save fundraising for this year. Hey, everybody. Well, I am happy to report that my fundraising has now reached my goal of $500, well ahead of my deadline. Thank you so much to all of my donors who generously donated toward my fundraising efforts. Really, really cool. And now I would love for you to donate to one of my team members, and I've created some new incentives for doing so. Before I get to that, though, I want to mention this coming Monday, October 24th, from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. Pacific, I will be doing the now unlocked Get Good live stream for 2022. And this year, I'm going to play some Castlevania, like the original NES Castlevania, because I love the Symphony of the Night style Castlevania games, and they make me want to just immerse myself in the whole franchise. But the whole franchise is not for me, because those original games on the NES are freaking hard. And so I'm going to beat my head against the wall some while I play some Castlevania during that live stream. And then I think the rest of the time may be devoted to all of the unlocks that I want to get in Spider-Man for PS4. I'll be playing it on PS5. But there's some optional side stuff that's really irritating, and all the more irritating when I'm hungry for what it will get me. And I want those unlocks. I'm hungry for them. That's what's going to truly make it irritating when I really, really want it. So I think that's what Monday night is going to be about. Again, the 24th, Monday, Pacific time, 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. at youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral. Okay, so now those new incentives for donating to team members for CGC's Game Save 22 event. First, if at least five members of the CGC team reach $100 in donations by the end of Thursday, November 3rd. November 3rd is the deadline, end of the day. $100 across five team members, I will cut myself off from all caffeine sources during the last 4 hours of my marathon. Traditionally, I very much rely on caffeine during the last hours of the marathon. So that means I'm going to have to get creative to stay awake during those hard final hours. So things might get a little extra kooky. But again, that depends on at least five team members reaching at least $100 each in their fundraising by the end of Thursday, November 3rd. Since I've already gone beyond $100, that just leaves four other team members to get there, several of whom are already most of the way, so it really won't take much to make that happen. Again, the link, as always, is below, although I've changed it now to go to my team fundraising page, so you can find out which members are at which amounts in their fundraising, and I update that daily. So anyway, the link is below this video, and I'll try to stick it in the podcast show notes too. The second incentive for now that I'm putting out there is if five of us have raised at least $100 and our team hits our team goal of $1,500 by the end of November 3rd. Right now, we're almost halfway there. We're like at $700 something. Anyway, if our team as a whole reaches $1,500 total by the end of Thursday, November 3rd, then in addition to five team members having at least $100 each in their donations, then I will cut out all caffeine during the last 7 hours of the marathon, which is scary to me. I don't think I've ever done that before. So that'll be from 11 p.m., which is like, that's the tail end of like when I'll typically go to bed. I don't stay up later really than 11, hardly ever, because it's just not fun to do anything, play games or anything like that. 11 p.m. is when the marathon just stops being really, truly fun. And at that point, I'm saying that I will cut off all caffeine for the rest of the marathon if at least five team members reach $100 each and our team reaches our total team goal of $1,500 by the end of Thursday, November 3rd. Again, link below to the team fundraising page. I would love for you to jump there now and help to make it happen. That's all for now. Don't forget about Monday's live stream. Thanks. Bye-bye. Now, as it stands at the moment, guys, because I am fighting some kind of bug and really don't know if I've seen the worst of it already or if it's going to progress,
Keep an eye on the YouTube channel to see if I end up having to reschedule that the 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. Pacific Get Good live stream this coming Monday, October 24th. I'll put some kind of like little teeny video up that really the notes below it will be the thing that you really will want to check out. But I'll put some kind of notification up on the YouTube channel if I need to reschedule that. Otherwise, you can count on that happening this Monday, the 24th. From 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. Pacific at youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral. Big news this week, over at spiritblade.com, I have released From Beyond, the Spirit Blade Productions adaptation of the classic tale of cosmic horror by H.P. Lovecraft, which includes alternate versions and a thematic commentary included. Enjoy a deeply unsettling tale exploring the fear of the unknown, and then you can explore fear itself from a biblical perspective with the included thematic commentary that I made for it. Here's a few sample clips I put together just to give you an idea.
Horrible beyond conception was the change which had taken place in my best friend Crawford Tillinghast.
I had indeed warned him 10 weeks before, when he burst forth with his tale of what he felt himself about to discover. I have always believed that such strange, inaccessible worlds exist at our very elbows, and now I believe I have found a way to break down the barriers.
We entered the laboratory in the attic, and I observed that detestable electrical machine, glowing with a sickly, sinister, violet luminosity. Listen to me. The waves from that thing are waking 1,000 sleeping senses in us.
During the interval that Tillinghast was silent, I fancied myself in some vast and incredible temple of long-dead gods. Some vague edifice of innumerable black stone columns reaching up from a floor of damp slabs to a cloudy height beyond the range of my vision. The picture was very vivid for a while, but gradually gave way to a more horrible conception. Then, from the farthermost regions of remoteness, the sound softly glided into existence. It was infinitely faint, subtly vibrant, and unmistakably musical, but held a quality of surpassing wildness, which made its impact feel like a delicate torture of my whole body.
"Don't move," he cautioned, "for in these rays we are able to be seen as well as to see. Remember, we're dealing with a hideous world in which we are practically helpless. Keep still."
Indescribable shapes, both alive and otherwise, were mixed in disgusting disarray, and close to every known thing were whole worlds of alien, unknown entities. Foremost among the living objects were great, inky, jellyish monstrosities which flabbily quivered in harmony with the vibrations from the machine. They were present in loathsome profusion, and I saw to my horror that they overlapped, that they were semi-fluid and capable of passing through one another and through what we know as solids. These things were never still, but seemed ever floating about with some malignant purpose.
"You see them? You see them? You see the things that float and flop about you and through you every moment of your life? What swept up the servants? What made them scream so loud? Don't know.
you'll know soon enough. Look at me. Listen to what I say. Do you suppose there are really any such things as time and magnitude? Do you fancy there are such things as form or matter? I tell you, I have struck depths that your little brain can't picture. I have seen beyond the bounds of infinity and drawn down demons from the stars. I have harnessed the shadows that stride from world to sow death and madness. Space belongs to me, do you hear?
And as I said, for the first time, outside of being a patron, it is available for anyone to purchase. You can go to spiritblade.com, where it is on sale for $9.99, or you can download it, once again, for a buck. If you jump on the $1 tier, even just for a month, you can get access to that entire project and even a little bit of extra content related to it. Or if you're feeling like, oh, no, I'm $9.99, I can do that, well, then you know, the $10 tier at Patreon gives you the ability to download all of our audio dramas and music. Again, patreon.com/Spirit Blade Productions. But you know what? If you don't want to mess with Patreon and you just want to, you know, get it outright and not go through the hassle of making an account for Patreon and stuff like that, $9.99, 10 bucks over at spiritblade.com. So anyway, yeah, I would appreciate your support or your interest, even if you just go check it out and decide not to get it. Yeah, grateful for that. ChristianGeekCentral.com, reminder again, it's now a links page, one place with quick, easy access to everywhere you can find Christian Geek Central online, including Patreon, YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, MeWe, Faith Social, our blog, forums, and of course, the Christian Geek Central podcast. So whichever of those kind of stands out to you as some, as a platform that you like to engage with, Christian Geek Central is there. And you can find your way to all those places just by visiting ChristianGeekCentral.com. Over at youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral this week, I posted the video When Christians Judge Our Hobbies, and that is the Colossians Bible study from last week's episode of the podcast in video form now. And then I also posted HeroQuest Quest 4, Prince Magnus's Gold, Part 7. I believe, yeah, this is where I step into the final boss room. So if you don't want to just cut to the big action, you can just jump on right here. Part 7 of playing through HeroQuest Quest 4. Also, I put up a video version of those From Beyond sample clips. I mean, there's no, like, it's not like a movie. It's just like the image of the cover art and then a little bit of information off to the side of it. But it's very shareable that way. And so I would be grateful if you would consider just using that YouTube video, including those sample clips, to just share it and let other people know about it. YouTube makes it really easy to share things. And so even if you are getting all that you want from Christian Geek Central through this podcast, anytime you want to share something over at youtube.com, it's a lot easier to kind of get in front of people through something like that. So also on Thursday of this week, actually I'm waiting for it to upload right now as I record this. If all has gone according to plan, authenticity, and representation. This was actually part two of the Games I'm in Love With live stream in early 2022. And for some reason, this hour just had some great conversation topics that you guys brought up and that I was happy to engage with and explore with you. And one of them is the idea of being authentic as a content creator or a live streamer. And what does that really mean? And are people really authentic? In what sense are they authentic? Are we, is it a realistic expectation for content creators and live streamers to be quote unquote authentic? Well, we have to understand what that means. And it was just an interesting topic for me to explore, to share what you're getting from me in terms of authenticity during my live streams. Am I putting up a front? Am I being a fake person? Or are you getting the real me? Or are you getting some nuanced thing that's not either of those? Spoilers, yes.
And then also, somehow the conversation drifted to representation in video games. That's a big thing right now in entertainment, especially coming from those that lean politically left and those wanting representation for like the LGBTQ community and other demographics, but pretty much not evangelical Christians. But anyway, I have some comments about that and what our attitude, I think, should be in regards to representation and how we should feel about not seeing ourselves positively represented in entertainment. So some really relevant and I thought good topics that you guys brought up that was just really enjoyable for me to dig into with you. And then if there was review content for this episode, like Black Adam or The Peripheral, then those hopefully will also be in video form as well. Again, at youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral, where below any recent video, you can also find updated upcoming dates for live events. And while you're visiting the channel or engaging with any of the videos there, if you'd be willing to like, share, subscribe, click that bell, and in general, do whatever else you would like to help spread this content around to those that you think could benefit from it, I'd be really grateful for that. Christian Geekly news highlights from our Twitter feed at @Christian_geek include just one item this week. Enclave Publishing tweeted out cover reveal for War of Torment, Volume 4, The Droseren Saga. It's a hardcover that's coming April 11th. Oh, crap, I didn't even notice that. That's my birthday. It's too bad I'm not a fan of this series. I'm not a fan. I'm not familiar with it at all. But dang, that could have been the perfect birthday gift for me. April 11th, 2023 is when War of Torment, Volume 4 of The Droseren Saga is coming. The description reads, "The time for peace is over. Now he demands vengeance. They followed him back, against his will, against his intention. Now enemies threaten from every direction. Amidst it all, Marco Dusan struggles to lead his people, to help them survive, even mayhap win the war. He will take any advantage to even the odds, but only after tragedy strikes does he learn just how much he's willing to sacrifice." All right, I guess I'll just truncate it to that. I did copy the whole back cover thing, but I'll just stop right there. Anyway, for a link to that little bit of news and to stay up to date on the notable news and events from the wider world of Christian geekery, be sure to follow Christian Geek Central on Twitter at @Christian_geek. I forgot last week to mention that at patreon.com/spiritbladeproductions, I posted the Pater's Brain journal entries for the month of September 2022. Which included me being really frustrated at myself for wasting some Spirit Blade Productions money, and dealing with stress was another topic, and then figuring out how to get the refund for this thing that I wasted money on. It was definitely a set of journal entries that was more about crap. I'm not doing well at life. Anyway, yeah, so you can get access to that, the audio version at the $1 tier and higher, the video version at the $5 tier and higher. If CGC or SBP content has been a valuable part of your routine, please consider becoming a patron at that $1 tier. I know these are financially difficult times for many, but if you are being blessed with financial stability right now and are already giving faithfully to your local church, I do want to stress that, then I'd be really grateful if you'd consider becoming a patron. And again, I'm so grateful for the support of all of our Spirit Blade insiders at all tiers who make it possible for me to continue in this work. Thank you guys so much. Again, for more info, you can always visit patreon.com/spiritbladeproductions. And now for a segment that hopefully doesn't suck. If it does, hang in there. The year is coming to an end soon. Welcome to the weekly word segment of the podcast, which I began in episode 687. You can go back, listen there for an introduction and explanation of intent for this segment. Each time I report on my ongoing experience of reading through the Bible in a year, which you're invited to do with me for any part of the endeavor, including, you know, this last stretch here. Anytime you want to jump on, you know, a little bit more Bible reading than you would normally do is great. Although, as I will mention here, I don't recommend exchanging an already helpful and meaningful habit for a read through the Bible in a year plan. That's not been going well for me. I haven't been able to bring myself to add more time to my allotted quiet time each morning, and I recognize that's on me. You know, that's a character issue. That's an issue of selfishness. That's an issue of not being able to maybe manage my schedule a little bit better. You know, so that's totally on me. But I definitely don't recommend at this point. Do not recommend a read through the Bible in a year plan in exchange for something meaningful that you're already doing in your quiet time in the Word. But anyway, yeah, my intent with this has been to kind of gain a broader zoomed out perspective on God's word. And the mission verse for me is I try to add this spiritual discipline to my life is 1 Timothy 4:8, which in the ESV says, while bodily training is of some value, godliness is of value in every way as it holds promise for the present life and also for the life to come. And this week I read Acts 17 through 28, Psalms 127 through 133, and Romans 1 and 2. And I have nothing to share about any of those passages or verses or chapters. Nothing stands out. It's just been, frankly, a shallow week of almost speed reading, and I need to make a change. My quiet time has still been good and useful each day, but only as a result of the prayer and meditation components of that time. I think I'm starting to resent the daily readings, and that's bad. That's a bad place for me to be. I think getting into the epistles now might help, but even reading Romans 1 and 2 this morning, I wasn't engaging in it much, thinking about it. Now, I do have to consider that at least part of that could be because I'm sick and drowsy. And when I woke up this morning, I was not at my best. It took me a while and a lot of water drinking and some caffeine to shake off the extra Benadryl I took overnight. So I was definitely in a pretty bad position to try to mentally and personally engage with the reading this morning. But I am seeing a need, I think, to take responsibility for my tendency toward being on autopilot lately in these readings and to re-engage my mind with the readings in a more intentional way. Still, though, I'm more than ready to get back to choosing my own passages or books to read in Scripture during that time. I'm just feeling over it with this reading plan. And that's all I've got to report this week, guys. In the meantime, I'll try to stick with it and to remember, as we're taught in 1 Timothy 4:8, while bodily training is of some value, godliness is of value in every way as it holds promise for the present life and also for the life to come. The Peripheral, Season 1 premiere on Amazon Prime. The synopsis on IMDb says, set in the future when technology has subtly altered society, a woman discovers a secret connection to an alternate reality as well as a dark future of her own. And the episode 1 description reads, Flynn Fisher is a brilliant gamer who works a dead-end job to support her brother and ailing mother. When her brother enlists her help in an advanced game, Flynn sees something she shouldn't, bringing danger to the family. Doorstep. All right, so what is this basic animal? Given the name Flynn and the spelling, which I think is the same as in the movie Tron, along with some visual elements that remind me of The Matrix, I mean, I think I can guess it may be some possible inspirations, but The Peripheral really feels like its own thing so far, which I really appreciate. It's listed as a sci-fi suspense drama, and I think that description fits pretty well. After the initial setup of Flynn's motive to take care of her mom, the rest is a mystery that's kind of slowly unfolding. There's intrigue, and she's putting herself in more and more danger for the sake of her family. So for me, it's a good character motive that justifies her actions and provides a reason that we can get behind for her to put herself in the danger of this mysterious sim world. And despite being, you know, a mystery that is kind of being slowly revealed, that shouldn't be interpreted as the show being slow. It didn't feel slow to me. I was really engaged all the time, and there's recurring strange elements of the sim world and visual effects that accompany them that are interesting to look at, and they also kind of tease. They're not just eye candy. They're also like, oh, what is going on there? So you're having these moments that are hinting at these future revelations, and I don't get the sense
that, like, say, Lost or other similar shows that are, you know, just being weird and mysterious for the sake of being weird and mysterious. No, it seems pretty clear to me that this show knows where it's going, it knows what the mystery is, and I'm on board for that because I find it very intriguing at this point. And despite being, you know, a suspense drama, that's not to say it's devoid of action. There are bits of action, but the focus is not on making them spectacular, like, say, in Ready Player One or The Matrix, but really making them intense, you know, and feeling the tension of those moments. And so I appreciate that. Oftentimes that is more useful to me and more engaging to me than the most outstanding eye candy you can put in front of me. So I'm very engaged with the story at this point. As far as the cast, Chloe Grace Moretz stars as Flynn, and while I still struggle to not see her as Hit Girl from the Kick-Ass movies, her performance so far really has been solid. The rest of the cast works for me too, although there hasn't been in this first episode a lot of truly intense emotions in the story to give me a sense of the true range of these performers. But so far, for what everyone is being asked to do, I think they all work well for me. As far as stunts and visuals go, I won't comment much on the stunts. There's not a ton of stunt work at this point. The visual style of this pilot feels very intentional, especially when you're inside the world of The Sim. It's stylized almost to the degree of The Matrix. Not done up quite that much in terms of how people are dressed, but and it's also updated to reflect current fashion. So we're not doing these kind of pseudo-goth vinyl suits and trench coats and stuff like that from The Matrix, but it does have a bit of that kind of runway vibe to it. Everyone's kind of like wearing very stylized clothing inside of The Sim. And in place of the green tint of The Matrix, the peripheral Sim world seems to be tinted copper a bit. It's a color scheme that actually, if you've played the video game Deus Ex Human Revolution, it reminds me of that color scheme. But yeah, characters and avatars inside The Sim also feel very dressed up, tailored, and otherwise ready for the runway. So while the type of movie is very different, I still do get some interesting Matrix vibes every now and then. The visual effects also look very impressive to me, falling well within the top tier of premium streaming service shows and high-quality theatrical movies. So this one is a real treat for the eyes in both the visual effects, visual design, and the cinematic qualities of the camera work, which used some focus effects and just some other little like subtle techniques that elevate this in terms of how much it looks and feels like a cinematic or a theatrical release product. So I'm very happy with just kind of visually how this thing is coming across. As far as themes, you know, I always like to ask, is there anything of moral, philosophical, or spiritual significance going on in the themes of this thing that might trigger some worthwhile thought or conversation? It's hard to say at this point what themes they might be playing with yet. I'm not seeing themes similar to other virtual world stories yet, such as, you know, the whole waking up to reality theme of The Matrix, and of course the other rich philosophical themes that were crammed into The Matrix trilogy. So I'm not really seeing that, or really the relational themes of Ready Player One, which kind of emphasized the importance of, you know, real flesh and blood interactions with other people instead of just always being in a virtual world. It doesn't seem like it's kind of making any of those kinds of commentaries. This virtual world so far is not about a power fantasy. Now, it may become that in future episodes. I can imagine that being the case, but right now it's not about the power fantasy. This is, if you were to compare it to The Matrix, you know, the first, you know, opening 45 minutes where he's in The Matrix, but he is a fish out of water, you know. So will it change? I don't know, but I'm interested to see. This is a dangerous place right now that Flynn needs a strong motive to enter. But I will say, just on the topic of themes, that between the fact that she's caring for her ailing mother, that she's dealing with the flaws and some of the self-destructive tendencies of her brother, I think that Flynn is positioned well in the peripheral to be used to express some themes about family relationships, you know, and just kind of like being committed to our family, even with the difficulties that come with that. So I think the pieces are in place for that, but I don't know. Time will tell. All right, now I have no idea what your tastes are in TV shows, but if I were a time traveler, I'd go back in time and say, Pater, Okay, well, you already have Amazon Prime, so watching this is just kind of a no-brainer. But you'll like it enough that you may want to wait until every episode of at least season one is released, instead of watching it week to week as they kind of drip feed new episodes, as that seems to be what they have planned. But you might want to wait because, man, by the end of the pilot, you're going to be ready to start right into episode two. And if all the episodes feel that way, it's going to be really hard to wait from week to week to watch a new episode. So anyway, this one's rated 16 plus for foul language, violence, alcohol use, smoking, and substance abuse. And those are all my thoughts for now on the series premiere for The Peripheral on Amazon Prime.
The truth will set you free.
Truth. That which corresponds to fact or reality. To assert that truth is not absolute is a self-defeating proposition. Now, lots of things are possible, but our beliefs should reflect the best explanation of the available evidence. I'm no expert, but the information is out there. You'd be amazed what you can learn if you spend some time in search of truth.
The truth will set you free.
Right now, I'm going to attempt to examine the Bible and dissect some of the churchy language we can easily take for granted, digging into history and languages as I'm able anyway, to try and get at the heart of the text so that we can hopefully see and then apply at least some of what God has for you and me in these words today. Now, I'm not formally trained in scripture. I'm just a guy using resources and a questioning mind to try and get at the truth, and that's something that we can all do, so I hope that you will do that with me. We've been studying through the book of Colossians and have arrived now at chapter 2, verses 20 through 23, which in the ESV says, "If with Christ you died to the elemental spirits of the world, why, as if you were still alive in the world, do you submit to regulations? Do not handle, do not taste, do not touch," referring to things that all perish as they are used, "according to human precepts and teachings. These have indeed an appearance of wisdom in promoting self-made religion and asceticism and severity to the body, but they are of no value in stopping the indulgence of the flesh." Okay, so we'll start with verse 20. "If with Christ you died to the elemental spirits of the world, why, as if you were still alive in the world, do you submit to regulations?" The Greek translated as the word "if" here, "if with Christ you died," actually communicates not uncertainty about the proposition, but sets it up as the basis for a logical argument. A translation that retains this sense intended might instead say, "since with Christ you died to the elemental spirits of the world," and then go on from there. The phrase "elemental spirits of the world" is the same here as used in verse 8, so it's worth going over again what we learned about it there. This phrase is translated as "basic principles" in the NIV. The original Greek here could have referred to basic principles of learning, like ABCs and 1-2-3s, which would have then been an insulting way of calling them simplistic rather than truly advanced, as proponents of them would claim. However, its other possible meaning seems more likely in this particular context, in which it would be referring to, as the ESV translates it, "elemental spirits of the world." The heresy at Colossae involved grouping Christ in with numerous spiritual beings that were equally viable alternatives. Paul also cautions against worship of angels in verse 18, and so this seems the most likely intended use of the Greek word, cautioning readers against adopting ideas that elevate the importance of other spiritual beings. So in verse 20, Paul seems to essentially be saying, "Since with Christ you became dead to the false spiritual ideas popular in the world, why, as if you still lived according to those ideas, do you submit to these regulations?" Verse 21 and 22, I'll read together, say, "Do not handle, do not taste, do not touch," referring to things that all perish as they are used, according to human precepts and teachings. Here Paul characterizes these regulations in summary. The focus seems to be dietary, and given that the rising worldview in Colossae was a blend of legalistic Judaism and pagan ideas, the dietary restrictions could have come from the Mosaic Law, some pagan philosophy, or both. But by this time, Jesus had declared all foods to be clean. We see that in Mark 7:19. And here Paul, having just said that dietary regulations and festivals are mere foreshadows of the true realities to come, we saw that in Colossians 2:17, he underlines this by showing that these dietary regulations are about things that all perish as they are used, as opposed to the eternal realities that they foreshadow. He also identifies these regulations as merely human in origin rather than divine. Now, of course, the Mosaic Law did come from God, but at this point, to continue observing those regulations is something merely human in origin and motivation. And verse 23. These have indeed an appearance of wisdom in promoting self-made religion and asceticism and severity to the body, but they are of no value in stopping the indulgence of the flesh. Now, the Greek word for flesh, I haven't mentioned this in our study series in a while, so I wanted to be sure and touch on this. The Greek word for flesh at the end of this verse is sarx, and it does not refer only to physical, biological matter. It's an expression referring to those elements in us that reflect the natural flow and state of broken humanity and a fallen world. You can see Galatians 5, verses 19 through 21 for examples of its use referring to non-physical qualities. Some translations translate the word sarx as sin nature. I think maybe the NIV does that. But an argument against that translation approach is the fact that we are told we have a new nature and are new creations in Christ, and that the old version of us is gone. So rather than thinking that we kind of have two natures, it's more accurate to see sarx in Christians, I think, as a remnant that clings to us, a very influential remnant, you know, like tar that sticks to our body, and it's like a constant problem, it's constantly on our mind. If you were covered in sticky tar that dried on you, you'd be thinking about it and dealing with it virtually every moment of your life. So it would be this very pervasive part of your experience, but not actually part of who you are, or something that defines you in any way. And I think that is the better way to see this word. So back to verse 23, Paul was warning that despite their appearances, these various pious activities and regulations didn't really help people break away from sinful habits and tendencies. All right, so what's in these verses maybe specifically for us geeks to come away with? I read these verses and I think about interactions with people online, which as geeks, you know, we sometimes do have more of those kinds of interactions than in-person interactions. Virtue signaling, very common online, got its name in the internet age, but it's been around as long as humans have. The natural tendency for both Christians and non-Christians is to try and morally justify ourselves before others and establish our moral goodness compared to others. And part of that attempt on our part can involve telling others, or I would say more often kind of implying by what we kind of announce or share regarding our own views. You know, we kind of imply by some of these things we say online what we think other people should also be doing or agreeing with morally. But before we engage in that kind of interaction or posting in various places online, I think these verses point out something very important. Things that appear to be wise, pious, disciplined, self-sacrificing, and God-honoring on the surface may actually be worthless in their usefulness to a life lived with Yahweh. They may seem synonymous with passionate dedication, obedience, and self-sacrifice, but do they actually stop the activities of the sinful worldly remnants that cling to not merely our actions, but our inner thought lives, from which our actions spring, as Jesus tells us? Works of the flesh in Galatians 5, 19 through 21 include, there's a big list of them, I recommend looking at all three of those verses, but among them include enmity, or we don't use that word often today. The idea, at least one key idea in that word, is hostility, we would maybe say today. So hostility, strife, or we would more commonly say arguing, quarreling, that kind of thing, and division. So these ideas of hostility, being argumentative, and being divisive. And it's often been the case in my experience that Christians and non-Christians who call for others to adhere to unnecessary, unbiblical self-restrictions or commands and priorities, those folks are among, in my experience, the most hostile, quarrelsome, and divisive people that I interact with, especially online, and without them even realizing it, I think. So not only do morally legalistic life regulations not help us avoid sin, in my experience, I think they contribute to making us blind to our own sin. I think, and I'll get to that, to why that might be in a second here. I think it's important to add a footnote or kind of take a little rabbit trail here and note that although God does not call for all of us to avoid, say, XYZ, I'm not going to say something specific, but, you know, God may not call all of us to avoid XYZ. However, if we are yielding our hearts to God, we are bound to discover some kind of X, Y, and Zs in our lives that he wants us individually to abstain from because of how it may lead us to sin, how it may hinder our growth, or in other ways, just kind of sidetrack us from what his specific will is for us. Going further down that rabbit trail for a moment, a temptation in those times of self-discovery when we realize, oh, I got to get away from this, or, oh, I need to prioritize this. You know, I think a temptation in those times of self-discovery, I've noticed this in myself, is to feel ashamed of our weakness and frustrated that we need to give something up. And we can then compensate for that feeling by resolving to hold others accountable to the same abstinence or command, since either because it feels unfair that we should have to give something up or do something that others don't, or we just kind of refuse to believe on like a subconscious level. I don't think these are conscious things, but we can just kind of almost on a subconscious level refuse to believe that we may actually be weaker and less mature than other believers around us. And the self-serving cherry on top is that by calling others to abstain from something that we consider sinful, we can kind of recover a sense of our own moral goodness relative to others. Oh, you know, I'm helping people. I'm in this position of helping them rise up to this new moral standard that I've kind of discovered, you know, to join me in that, you know. The phrase putting the cart before the horse comes to mind as I think about this kind of stuff. Imposing a bunch of boundaries and rules on ourselves, while appropriate at times, will not naturally lead to a change in our hearts. That's putting the cart before the horse. But if we start with instead gratitude and love for God, and with a desire to understand ourselves and the world through him, if we do that first and we're prioritizing that, we will find that our lives do change. Our perspectives, our feelings about things will change. I've noticed this in my life. And then both our thoughts and our actions will change. And on a much deeper, natural feeling and transformative level than we could try to bring about by manufacturing our own righteousness.
Incoming transmission.
This week over at youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral, under the video I posted titled When Christians Judge Our Hobbies, SpiderDan1985 wrote, "Thank you again, as always, Pater. Encouraging and thought-provoking. I definitely have difficulty with having those conversations and not getting defensive or aggressive about it. I guess my response now is to not engage at all. Just before watching your video, I saw a short of someone saying all anime is satanic and that adults shouldn't watch cartoons. Haha. No argument was actually made. It was more of just a broad statement. I'm sure all of us Christian geeks have stories we could tell." And yeah, it's interesting that you said that there's no argument being made. It was just this broad statement. I think we see a lot of that online. We see a lot of people just kind of making position statements, but not really being thoughtful about how they present that view claim on their part of what of something, you know, not substantiating or justifying their position. It's just a lot of passion and attitude, which is unfortunate. Hot Rod followed up to Spider Dan's comment saying, "Yeah, definitely have to try to not take it personally. It's difficult to not make our interests our identity. It may not be a personal attack. We may not know what the other person has going on. So if someone criticizes something we like, it's easier to keep a level head by keeping our hobbies and identities separate. Believe me, it is easier said than done. As far as the anime comment goes, we know that the personalities in that
organization, quote unquote, are kind of pretentious. LOL. And I didn't know. I don't know what he's talking about, who these people are. So I'll take your word for it, I guess. Owen Pater, he says, fantastic video, by the way. Thank you so much for doing this channel. It's an absolute blessing. God bless you, brother. Well, first up, thank you, Dan. It's tricky stuff for sure to navigate those kinds of interactions with people who are judging our hobbies. Still requires a lot of me sometimes to have those conversations. And thank you also, Hot Rod. That was encouraging to hear. And your comments on identity are really so key to this issue. So thank you for adding that element. Over at the forums at ChristianGeekCentral.com, Adam Collings started a new thread titled, Henry Cavill is Back. And he writes, so Henry Cavill is back as Superman, including a cameo in an upcoming movie and talks of a Man of Steel sequel. And then he links to an article from The Hollywood Reporter and goes on to say, I honestly have no idea how I'm supposed to feel. I feel like my Superman fan heart has been dragged through the gravel for so long that my emotions have become numb and non-functional. On one hand, this is everything I've ever hoped for, but I can't help but fear that without the involvement of Zack Snyder, we're just going to get more smiling, brightly colored Joss Whedon Superman. And I'd rather have no Superman than that. I know that Zack doesn't have to be involved in order to get the kind of Superman I like. David S. Goyer and Chris Terrio were just as instrumental in the creation of the Man of Steel Superman as Zack was. And new director slash writers could still give us a similar tone. But what if they don't do that? Hendy wants Superman, I don't know, Hendy, I think that was a name referenced in the article. Anyway, wants Superman to grow beyond, Henry is, I think it's a typo. Henry wants Superman to grow beyond the place the character was in during Man of Steel and Batman vs. Superman, and I'm okay with that. I like character growth and development. I just want the growth to be done right. I always said that Man of Steel was Superman's starting point. I think Zack Snyder's Justice League gave us a good rebirth of a more optimistic but still serious Superman. Hopefully, it'll be along those lines. In any case, there is reason to hope. The new management of DC seem to be steering back toward my preferred direction. If they'll go as far as I want, only time will tell. If I can't have what I really want, a full restoration of the Snyderverse and canonization of Zack Snyder's Justice League, then hopefully I can at least have something good. But I'm now at the point where I have to give the DCEU another chance. I'll see Black Adam, and I'll hope. And then he adds right after that in another post, my last post might have come across more negative than I intended. I am genuinely happy that Henry's back. Yeah, as a number of you guys who've been listening for a while know, I am in the seeming, Adam and I are in the seeming minority of people that that really loved Zack Snyder's movies and much prefer a very serious tone to our superhero fiction. And I think we have reason to hope that even without Snyder, the DC movies will be at least allowed to. I'm not saying they'll all go this route, or that they should all go this route. But I think the DC movies will be allowed to retain some weight, or at least some edge. I saw an article title, although I didn't read the article itself, mentioning that Black Adam had to put some work in to get it down to a PG-13 from an R. Now, I'm recording this before I've seen Black Adam, so maybe that review is part of this podcast, and I've already said, this is freaking happy-go-lucky and smiley as all get out. What the crap happened? I don't know. This is Pater from Thursday talking. But anyway, it did have an R rating they had to chisel it down to. Shouldn't read too much into that. I think a lot of times movies will, the directors kind of know they're not going for an R at any point, but their director's cut, can qualify as an R movie. Sometimes it's not like a major spike of content, like some dude's head gory, explosion or something. But it's just like one too many gunshots. Like there's these certain thresholds that if there's a certain number of this, then it bumps up to the next, rating or whatever. So I don't think we should assume necessarily that the director in his mind was going for an R movie and that's what a potential director's cut would be. I don't know. But evidently, it did have to be, whittled down to a PG-13. But more than that, even to me, is the trailers have always suggested seriousness and dramatic weight to me. Although, again, this is Thursday Pater talking, and maybe I was fooled. And although not serious, the recent Suicide Squad movie had an R rating that was well-earned through its, gory content and other elements. So I don't think WB is trying to do the family film vibe for this universe, like Disney is obviously doing these days for Marvel. I also suspect that after the experience with Whedon and the resulting backlash for his interpretation, those both in front of and behind the camera in those days, including Henry Cavill, will almost certainly be ready to push back against mandates to keep things bright for the kiddies, you know, or something like that. So all that said, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens after Hamada's exit. In that article that Adam linked to, there's differing reports on whether or not there's an actual power vacuum. But there's in one sense, there's signs that maybe a bunch of people are scrambling to try and put their vision of the DCEU going forward into play. Or some of them just like trying to grab while there's not as much oversight and see if they can get something greenlit, you know. So, it's at the very least right now, I don't think we have probably a clear vision and a cohesion for all of these movies. But that's been the case already for a little while. And I think if anything, I'm okay with that. I've said for a long time that, and was originally saying this about the Marvel movies in some sense of disappointment, that comic book movies do not need to, nor do I think they should, be confined to one tone, but should really be able to have wildly different tones between all of them, because that's what we see in the world of comic books. When I think about the history of DC Comics, you know, a Superman book, well, and tones also change from creative team to creative team, not just, time changes it, the styles of writing and what the audiences want change it. They're so malleable that even just a single character can have a book that changes tone significantly over the course of a run with, you know, changing up creative folks. But even if those things were completely consistent, you know, Swamp Thing or Animal Man is going to play very differently than Teen Titans Go, you know, or Supergirl. And I think that's appropriate. It does make it challenging when you bring them together for like a, you know, an Avengers movie, or in this case, a Justice League movie, to figure out, okay, well, what tone is a meeting place for what all of these characters are used to being in? What tone works? And I think you can figure that out. I think there's some, and there's some little ways that you can change tone now and then, you know, where even if you have a bonkers character like Deadpool, who's breaking the fourth wall, I think you could throw him into an Avengers movie that's taken very seriously and still have this one moment where he looks at the camera and says something and then just goes on like nothing ever happened. I think you got to recover from that, and you got to figure out, okay, now how can we get the audience to re-enter into this movie as a weighty experience we want them to take seriously? But as I guess I haven't mentioned this in a while. I was almost going to apologize. Like, sorry, I'm mentioning this show again. It's been a little while since I mentioned Farscape. But when I think about Farscape, that was a show that could really, in some episodes, very impressively change tone on a dime. And it worked. Like, I would be laughing and then, like, feeling tense or almost, you know, about to cry in another scene. I mean, there's, like, really, I think about the episode where John was having his mind messed with, and so he was in this alternate reality with twisted versions of people from his real life populating this dreamlike world. And there was some bonkers, crazy stuff in there, but then there was also a very haunting sequence where he was interacting with his mom, who was in the midst of dying of cancer. There's some heavy stuff and some bonkers stuff. And so, yeah, I think, just to circle back to Adam's comments, I think there is definitely plenty of room, especially with how the DC movies right now are not really focused underneath a single creative mind or executive producer or whatever. I think there's all the more reason to think right now that there's room for those kinds of things. And hopefully whoever they do get to kind of lead the charge with all these things will recognize the value in having different tones and will be willing to take on the challenge of finding those meeting places for characters that they have cross over into each other's movies or into a single movie or something. So Let's see. Is that all I had to say? Did I go on a rabbit trail? I definitely went on a rabbit trail, but did I read all my original comments before that? I think we have reason to hope that even without Snyder, DC movies would be allowed to retain some weight or edge. Blah, blah, blah. Suicide Squad. No. It's just going to be interesting to see what happens after Hamada's exit, which is the guy that is running it all now. And I think maybe by the time I record this, he's out. He's done. I'm not sure. Anyway. But thank you for bringing up that topic, Adam, just so that I could enjoy geeking out and talking about it. Over on the Discord channel, which is exclusive for patrons, but patrons of any tier can get access to the text channels over there. And over on the Geek Out channel, I believe it was, David JWB posted regarding The Cult of the Lamb. This is a small indie game that came out recently. Said, any thoughts on this game from you guys? Honestly, I think it looks kind of fun, but wasn't sure if it was appropriate to play. And Justin D. Myers chimed in saying, it's obviously a satire, I believe. Looks like it's an entertaining game. Does it make you sin or tempt you to sin? If yes, probably should put it down. If no, continue to enjoy it. Falls under Can Christians Be Evil in Games category, I think. And then he adds, one caveat I would make, though, is that what we consume media-wise does slowly affect us. So consume video games like this wisely and with the correct mindset. What that is between you and God, however. Like, personally, I have to be careful of any video game that objectifies the body too much. That's where I run into trouble, and it's an issue because I love me a JRPG, but they can be pretty bad about that. And this was a really interesting topic to come back to, specifically with this game, The Cult of the Lamb. I considered trying to get a review code for this one, but just had too many other things on my plate to really intentionally pursue that. Mechanically, it may not be my kind of game anyway, which is part of the reason I was like, I can let this one go. Obviously, there'd be a ton I could comment on regarding the theme, just looking at the trailers alone, but mechanically, it didn't look like it was necessarily going to be my kind of game. The tone for it seems to be one of absurdity rather than trying to preach some message. I personally find that when comedy just becomes completely absurd, it's not something that seems to be harmful to me because the very point of everything is that it has this sort of chaotic incoherence rather than some kind of message or stance that is propped up by any kind of consistency. When something's truly absurd and is just kind of going off the rails, then you don't sense those messages as much, I don't think. However, the crosses in the logo for Cult of the Lamb make me suspect that the devs are aware that Christ is compared to a lamb in the Bible, and so they may be kind of riffing on biblical ideas more than is immediately apparent. I don't know. That said, my guess is that if this game became problematic for me, it would be more because it bums me out as I think about where the developers are at spiritually, not because it would in some way compromise my life in Christ. Interesting, though, particular scenario to kind of take a look at. That's it, guys. Feedback. Give me your thoughts. Strike up some chat on our forums at ChristianGeekCentral.com. Leave a comment at YouTube.com/ChristianGeekCentral or Patreon.com/SpiritBladeProductions. You type it, I read it, and might even share it on the show. Unless you tell me not to or want to be anonymous, that's fine too. You can also email me a text or audio message at PAETER@SpiritBlade.com. I'd love to hear from you anytime and most anyway. And if you'd like some help finding a good church in your area, I would love to help you do that. Online resources and communities are good supplements, but by nature they can't speak to your particular situation like relationships in a local church can. The context for almost everything in the New Testament assumes that we are serving and building purposeful relationships in a local church. So whether you're in a church that lacks Bible-based intentionality or not attending any church at all, if I can help you get connected to an authentic, compassionate, Bible-oriented church, I would love to do that. Email me, please, PAETER@SpiritBlade.com, and we can try to look at some websites of churches in your area together. If you're not going to any kind of church right now, but you like to kind of do the Christmas Eve service type thing, well, now would be a good time to start looking so that maybe you could go to that Christmas Eve service and at the same time be testing the waters for a church that you might consider attending. So you can get ahead of the game, and I can help you as much as I'm able and would love to do that. So again, please email me, PAETER@SpiritBlade.com. Now it's time for my Geek Week highlights of the geeky stuff that I have been up to. This week, just one movie and then a bunch of games.
First off, the movie Parasite. This is a Korean film that was highly praised by critics, and I found it in the horror section of, was it Hulu? I don't know. It was a streaming service I currently am subscribed to. And it's a drama. I don't think it's a horror movie. It's a drama with brutal, bloody violence in the climax. And it explores themes of economic classes and doesn't villainize the rich for a change. I thought that was interesting. But I definitely would not describe this as horror. Very disappointed that it was listed in that category. So I don't really have much more to say about it, except in the way of a public service announcement. If you've been curious about Parasite and been told it's this great horror movie, I don't think it's a horror movie. So feel free to give that one a pass if you're really hoping that that's what it is. Moving on to games now. I played Potion Permit through a Gamefly subscription that I have for this month, and it's often compared, I've seen some reviews already for it, it's often compared to Stardew Valley, but with a tighter focus, which I think is probably true. I've only played a couple hours of Stardew Valley, and it's been a while, but I think I can still say that. It's pixel art, it's kind of that isometric, well, faux isometric, because it's not literally in a 3D space. It's pixel art, and it's, I would say it's more like PS1, PS2 pixel art, which wasn't as common. They were going 3D a lot, but it's not, you know, all the way back to SNES. And the sprites are a little bit bigger, and so I actually like the aesthetic more than Stardew Valley. You play a chemist who's representing an organization, I don't know, Big Pharma or something. I don't know what the equivalent would be in this pseudo-fantasy world. But, well, no, it is. It's straight-up fantasy. It's not a pseudo. It's nothing pseudo about it. It's a fantasy world. And you're representing this chemist's organization or medical firm or whatever that's from the big city in the capital that in some way hurt the village at this point. At some point, you didn't do it, but this company that you work for was responsible for doing some harm in some way to the village, and that's not clear what exactly was done. You get a sense of that about, an hour and a half to 2 hours in. So this village that you're trying to help doesn't trust chemists, but you're sent to try and help the town by your company and to try and get a foot in the door for a guild presence. And you're called there by the mayor. It's not, you're not just completely uninvited, but the mayor doesn't represent the feelings of everybody else because he's desperate for his daughter to be cured. So he invites you and he tries to kind of give you some tips on how to get along and make good connections and with people in the town. But anyway, you kind of explore this pixel art town and the surrounding wilderness, grinding for components in simple combat and like mining and, you know, component gathering from plants and things. And you do that to make potions as people are sick and come to the clinic. And I said already I like the visuals more than Stardew. I think I like the gameplay more too, although I need to get back into Stardew Valley again to confirm that. I didn't connect with Stardew Valley at the time because I didn't like the stamina system where you just, after so much work during the day, you couldn't do any more. You had to go back to your cabin, your house or whatever, and sleep. And I didn't like that. I was just like, just let me stay in this groove of chopping down trees and stuff. But there's a similar mechanic here, and I don't know, maybe the stamina meter wasn't depleted as quickly. It didn't seem as much of a nuisance, or maybe I was just more prepared for it now. So that's why I want to go back and give Stardew Valley another try after playing this. The game doesn't always make things as clear as it could. For example, saving, how to save the game doesn't make it super clear. You just need to sleep at your house, and that's when it saves the game. You can't trigger a save any other way. It might have an autosave feature that saves it a few other times, but if you want a guaranteed save so that you can, you know, be done with it for the day, you got to go back to your house and sleep. And that's not too big of a deal. There's teleport points that you unlock as you explore, and one of them's right next to your house, and you can actually, you don't have to be at a teleport point to go to a teleport point. You can be anywhere on the map and then just open up the overworld and say, that's right, that's the marker, that's the teleport point I want to go to, and Zammo, you're there. Anybody else say Zammo? I don't normally. That just came out. So Zammo, there you go. But I mean, like, yeah, saving wasn't really clear how to do that. They put ingredient markers on the map so that you can, you know, help, so it can help you find the ingredients that you want for the current potion you're trying to brew, but they tell you where those plants or resources are, not whether you've mined them or not. They do seem to regrow, respawn, etc. after you sleep for a night. So I guess maybe it's not that big of a deal, but I kind of wish that it would show them on the minimap when they're there and available for pickup or mining, and then they would go away when they're not. And then also, I finished my time with it on this little quest to befriend people in town. But like where those people are is a bit of a mystery. I'm just wandering around back and forth, and what exactly I need to do to befriend them isn't clear. And so I'm not feeling exactly stuck, but compared to the quests up to this point, this one seems to involve more wandering and mystery as to how to get it done, which I'm finding a little bit lame. But the world is on a clock. It's on a day-night cycle in addition to being on a clock. And when people come to your clinic that need treatment, you go in there, you have to diagnose their thing, what's wrong with them through a little mini game. And then you brew a potion if you have the components, and that's also a little mini game. And you have like so many days to help them while they are in your clinic. And if that time runs out, then the family or whoever that brought him there will say, you know what, we're just going to take him to the local naturalistic health provider. Because there is kind of a quote-unquote doctor in the town, but he doesn't ever do any mixing of ingredients and create compounds. He just uses straight resources from the land. You know, like, here, this is a berry. We're not going to mix this berry with anything. You just eat this berry and it'll help you or whatever. And so, as you can imagine, sorry, I just got a text. I need to look at this. Hang on. Okay, sorry. Yeah, his ability to actually heal people of their ailments is limited compared to yours. But that's where they'll take him if you don't bring about results for the patient within a certain number of days. So that's where the clock and the day-night cycle kind of comes into play. As far as I know, I don't think that the calendar itself is limited. Like, you have this many weeks or months to finish the campaign, or else something happens and you lose the whole thing. I don't get the sense that it's that kind of game. It doesn't seem like it's a game that's meant to be challenging. It is very peaceful and tranquil, and the music serves that purpose. The combat and how easy and straightforward it is so far seems to be serving that agenda. It's just, you know, one of those chill kinds of games. There are, as I said, multiple mini games for diagnosing and brewing, and they're pretty simple. I thought the brewing one was harder than it is at first. If you watch some reviews of this game, they'll show examples of it where each ingredient has a corresponding Tetris looking puzzle piece that you have to fit into this shape that is in the pot, the alchemy pot, in order to brew the potion successfully. And so it'll say, you know, these are the type of ingredients you can use to make this kind of potion, and you have to fill up all the spaces in this weird little shape that's in the cauldron. And you can't rotate the Tetris things. I think that actually would have overcomplicated it for me. So I thought initially, oh man, I'm going to hate this. This is going to be too complicated. But really, it's only challenging for me so far if I'm low on ingredients and low on options. Like, okay, I really got limited options. Got to figure out how exactly to make them work in this, to create this shape in the cauldron. Conceptually, I'm still not a big fan of it because it takes it into this weird abstract kind of place where I would prefer that they represented that in some other way. Like they said, I'd have to think more than, you know, you want the dead air for that on the podcast. But anyway, yeah, if you got plenty of ingredients, in my experience so far, it's not really challenging to put those things together. And the other mini games I found even simpler. Although they so far are not puzzly, they're a little bit more like reactionary. Like there's a little, almost a rhythm game type thing where you see the symbols coming for the buttons that you need to press. And as soon as they pass over this target spot, that's when you need to hit that
corresponding button. But you're not doing it to the beat of music. But I mean, apart from that aspect, it reminds me of like a rhythm game type thing. There's a memory one where like Simon, it'll show you the crosspad button and go up, down, down, left. And then you got to repeat that up by button inputs. And so far it's been, really simple. So as long as it doesn't get a lot more complicated, I suspect they'll probably become a little more challenging as the game goes on. But as long as they don't become, crazy challenging, which I don't think they would, then I'm totally fine with these mini games and, using them to do these different things. The story and the theme is interesting to me, and I typically am not interested in games for their stories. But this story reminds me of how today we can be hurt by a certain type of person or a demographic of people. And it may be people that are of a different political persuasion than you are, or whatever. And that can make us hesitate to trust others of that same demographic. And it especially makes me think of us as Christians trying to, just as this chemist is in this town, trying to help people. The chemist that you play, whatever kind of evil your corporation might have been up to, you don't get the sense that your avatar that you're playing as was a part of that, would agree with it or anything like that. You're a person that just wants to help. And so it made me think of, how us as Christians are wanting to go out into the world and interact with and help people to see Jesus for who he is. But some of those people have been hurt by other Christians. So our work is really cut out for us as we have to fight that reputation or those scars that they have. Now, it seems very unlikely that this parallel was intended by the developers, but it just struck me as such a strong parallel that could be drawn, that it brought me to connect with my avatar and want to help these people. Potion Permit, it's called. It goes for $20 on console and PC, all three of the main consoles and on PC. I might pick it up when it's half that price. Right now, it's something I'll likely only enjoy in short sessions and when I'm in a particular mood, but I find it very charming and inviting in its vibe. So again, that's called Potion Permit. Scorn. This one came out late last week and had a lot more buzz associated with it. It's had a long lead-up time. If you're not quite remembering which one this is, it's this first-person exploration-looking game with an environment and creatures obviously heavily and I think exclusively inspired by H.R. Giger's designs for the original Alien movie. And just this kind of like biological biotech horror type setting. And so it's, I was very interested in this. I was like, this could finally be the kind of horror game that I will enjoy because it looks like it's going to be more about disturbing the player, unsettling the player than it is making the player jump or killing the player really easily, which is what most horror video games are all about. This one, oh man, I really wanted to engage with it. I ended up playing less than 30 minutes because right off the bat, it's like this really just seems like a puzzle game to me. There was no music. There was no intro to the story. They just plop you into this environment and you don't know how you got there or what exactly you are. You can look down and see that you're not human or not a normal human because you're looking all weird and giggery yourself. And there's no enemies, at least at the start of the game. I believe there are later on. I think that's certainly been confirmed. In fact, I know it has, because I've seen footage of it. But I didn't get far enough in to encounter any. It's just this great visual atmosphere and puzzles. And I just hate puzzles. I hate them. And so I realized, man, if that's the main way to progress in this game, sadly, I am out. But anyway, if you like puzzle games and you like that kind of horror that's not necessarily about making you jump, but just about kind of unsettling you with a really striking visual environment, Scorn, you might find worth checking out. Although definitely check other reviews. I think there's been some major bugs going on in it as well. But yeah, that's Scorn. Ayudin Chronicle Rising was a game I checked out. Since I had Game Pass, I was like, oh crap, I'm not going to do a review of Scorn. I'm just not the guy to do a review of a puzzle game. But I'd already spent the money out of Spiritly Productions' budget, and so I was like, how can I leverage this for something that could be of potential value to other people. So I looked through the other games that I had access to on Game Pass, and one that was still, you know, fairly recent, I want to say maybe 1 to 2 months ago it came out, is Ayudin Chronicle Rising. And this is a prequel to the Ayudin Chronicle game that's coming sometime in 2023, which is heavily inspired. It's a spiritual successor to the Suikoden games, which I played the first one way back on PlayStation 1, didn't play any of the follow-ups, but this material I've seen presented at various game events for Ayudin Chronicle looks really cool and like something I might really enjoy. Ayudin Chronicle Rising is kind of like a whet-your-appetite kind of game that takes place in that world, uses, I think, maybe similar, if not the same, art assets, but it's a different type of game. It's more of a side-scrolling, action-y game that's not very challenging, and, gosh, it's a little bit similar in its plot to Potion Permit, because you arrive in this town, and, well, I should say that, you know, like, I spent more time in towns and in dialogue than a Metroidvania game. But in other ways, I would describe it a little bit like a Metroidvania, although it's not, there's not really vertical exploration. You're just kind of going to these levels that are mostly horizontal, moving left to right or right to left. But yeah, the first, I don't know, I would say 1/3 to 1/2 of the time I spent playing that game, which is did I spend 3 hours with it? Maybe 2 or 3, I can't remember. But like 1/3 to 1/2 of that was spent walking around in the village talking to people, which I was like, ugh, I don't know if I'm into this. Let's see. CJ, your character, is an emancipated miner seeking to be a treasure-hunting adventurer. And CJ comes to town. She's looking for adventure and reward and begrudgingly has to help the townsfolk to get to her scavenging life started. Early signs of her, let's see, early sign of early, oh, okay, there are early signs, sorry, I made these notes almost a week ago. There are early signs, as I played the game, of her kind of losing track of her drive to become this adventurer, treasure hunter, that kind of thing, and becoming attached to the townsfolk and to their situations. And so I'm thinking the game's story may end up being a moral about really investing in people versus tasks or personal aspirations, which I think that's a cool theme. So what I'm seeing of it already is like, oh, I'm digging this theme. The story, it's like, it goes in one ear and out the other. Just give me the quest, give me the quest marker, and I'll be on my way, you know? So I'm not that really invested in the story in the typical sense, but the theme of the story I am interested in. Combat's very simple so far, far more than a symphony-like, I think. It has fairly relaxed and charming vibes to it, almost as relaxed as Potion Permit, so it doesn't look like it's out to be a challenging game. And it uses HD 2D graphics and effects very well, if you know what I'm talking about. That's where, Octopath Traveler, that's a great example of HD 2D. And, you know, but I mean, like, rather than do that, if you've not heard of this game and you're interested, you can search for it. Let me spell that for you. E-I-Y-U-D-E-N. E-I-Y-U-D-E-N. Ayudin Chronicle Rising. All right, so moving on, let me talk just briefly about Game Pass, because I had kind of a bit of a revelation while I was browsing through Game Pass to see what I might kind of try out. And I think perhaps an overlooked value for this service, at least with the library they currently have, but I think some of these games, I'm like, well, these games have been there for a while, I think. But I think this could be of real value to those who are interested in games that have short play times, but that otherwise look good. You know, some of these more story-oriented gaming experiences where they're still, you know, maybe they're not the full $60 or $70 of new games, but even if they're like $50 or $40, like, man, if you still compare the hours of play that I get out of that for my money compared to this other thing, that's like, you know, just really a big dip in value for dollar for some of these games. And so I'm thinking that maybe some games like Telling Lies or like Immortal or what's this one? There's one about this, I can't remember what the name of it is, but it's about like this family that gets caught up in crime in Arizona, I think it is. that I'm kind of interested in. It looks like a fairly cinematic, almost a video game version of a choose your own adventure type deal. So these kinds of experiences that are well produced and certainly had a lot of work and thought and quality effort put into them, but at the end of the day, the asking price for it is just, you know, more than I want to pay. So I think Game Pass, when it has those kinds of games in it, several of those could be a significant value, especially since these really story heavy games, I think in most cases are, you know, easily experienced once and then you let them go. Even if they have branching paths, I mean, if you want to go down every branching path, usually story games, it doesn't add a ton, you know, doesn't bring them up to the hours of an open world game or something like that. But yeah, it just seems like if, it could be a good way to experience those kinds of games. So yeah, you can keep an eye out for those types of titles if you want to consider Game Pass as an option. Baldur's Gate on the PlayStation 4. Okay, I was this week having a great time, but eventually it does become cumbersome. Inventory management is a major activity, and I'm spending way too much time on it at this point. Identifying items first, using a limited number of spells that are only recharged every time I sleep, and then once I've identified them, then grouping them, which character is going to carry them, which character is it best suited for, because there's no like group inventory. Everybody has their own inventory that's limited in terms of slots and weight. And then selling them or stashing them or swapping them between characters, you know. And I also have so much money at this point, but I haven't found a useful sink for it yet, despite wanting to just blow it all on consumables or spells that will mitigate the mind control types of spells enemies are slowly beginning to use more and more often. I'm like, crap, I have money. Give me something to buy that will deal with this problem. Because I can't learn the spells yet, and I don't see anything for sale that's really going to help me deal with this. It feels like we're now well into the beginning of the end of my enjoyment of Baldur's Gate. Now, when I played this on PC, I'll still say that the original Baldur's Gate was one of my favorite of all time. It's because on PC, I could just open up the console commands and just bump my guys up two or three levels. And then keep going from there, and they'd save more easily against these mind affecting spells. But I can't do that on the PS4 version. I actually uninstalled the game once already and then reinstalled it because I was like, maybe you were too hasty. Let's reinstall it. Let's get back into it. But then I reached this point that I'm describing just a few hours later, and I suspect I'm not actually done for good. I'm just ready to move on to several other types of games inspired by Baldur's Gate that have streamlined these issues or given more nuanced difficulty options to deal with them. Perhaps after I finish them and had time away from the genre, which I'll probably need because there's like three of these that are modern versions of a Baldur's Gate game that I'm excited to play, I think, or at least very interested in playing. So if I played all those back to back, I'd almost certainly want to break from the genre anyway. So it's going to be a ways out. But perhaps once I've finished those, been away from the genre for a bit, I'm hungry for it again. I suspect that'll be years from now, not weeks or months. But I think at that point I'll come back and I'll realize that I'm decently close to the end of Baldur's Gate 1, and we'll have sort of a Kingmaker type of, revival in my motivation to finish it off, as I had with Pathfinder Kingmaker once I figured out what I needed to do to minimize or eliminate the crashes. Oh, man. Excuse me. All right. I haven't been coughing up to this point, but I also haven't been testing my voice by fatiguing it through recording a podcast. So hopefully that's just a little bit of fatigue, not the beginning of coughing. Blah. But yeah, I'm shelving Baldur's Gate on the PlayStation 4 for now. And then finally, Four Against Darkness. I got back into Pathfinder the Adventure card game this week. And I really like that over Four Against Darkness in the sense of its great art and its enemy variety. And it's got really diverse, cool mechanics married to theme. There's a lot more mechanically going on in Pathfinder than in Four Against Darkness. But it also gets a bit samey in some ways, and I kind of get caught up in dice assembly math, where it's like, okay, here's the check I need to make.
What are the cards in my hand that could contribute to this? And then once I factor in how each card could contribute, I got to kind of assemble all of my dice. So even though it is richly thematic, there is a point when you're making these checks where it does start to get caught up a little more than I want in figuring out dice math and assembling this big hand to shook a drop. It's less like pushing my luck like I want it to be in a dungeon delve game, and more like preparing to roll. Four Against Darkness, though, is much more push your luck, push your resources, but it has less monster variety, fewer ability simulations, both among monsters and heroes. And you've got one character that has to carry that lantern, and it makes him almost irrelevant in combat. Now, I have house ruled that after the first round of combat, the lantern carrier can set it down at his feet and then join combat, which is still going to be pretty limited because I keep him in the back row, so he can only use ranged weapons. And I think you maybe need a turn to pull out your ranged weapon or something. No, not if you've already got it out. Anyway, this is largely a solo game. You can play it however you want, so that's what I'm doing. It is more limited in its overall mechanical flavor. Like, in other words, by that I mean the varying mechanics used to simulate elements of flavor, such as drinking a potion or whatever. I'm having a good time with it. I'm interested in some new expansions for it, but I may be even more interested in exploring some kind of Dungeons & Dragons to Four Against Darkness conversion. I really didn't want to play solo Dungeons & Dragons because I realized, what I primarily care about is the dungeon delving. I still greatly prefer that dungeon crawl focus. I don't want to wander around talking to people and finding people and solving mysteries and stuff like that and going along with some plot. I don't really care about that stuff. But if I can just read those story and flavor and choices and things like that instead of actually playing them out, I can still feel a more frequent sense of inhabiting and affecting a world outside of just doing the combat in it, which is mostly what Four Against Darkness is about. It's about pushing your luck and, you know, doing some pretty simple combat and then going back to town and preparing for the next delve, you know. And so I could get a little bit more, I think, richness and sense of inhabiting a world if I were to use Four Against Darkness rules and characters and stuff and monster stats and all that to play through a Dungeons & Dragons campaign. And there's already somebody that's put out like a suggested conversion method for this, which is not as complicated as you would think. It's actually very straightforward, and it doesn't simulate all the things that Dungeons & Dragons simulates, of course, but that's kind of the point when you're playing Four Against Darkness. You don't want to simulate all that stuff. You want just some of that sense of story and inhabiting the world, interacting with the world without it getting bogged down with all the mechanics of doing that. The challenge, I think, in doing this is going to be coming up with new monster stats, but I have acquired enough expansions that I have a lot of different monsters. Like, the monsters I actually have access to, there's really great variety. When I say that Four Against Darkness doesn't have as much monster variety, what I mean by that is you establish before going into a dungeon what sets of monsters you are capable of running into. And when you have a monster encounter, it's either going to be one monster or a group of the same kind of monster. You're not going to have werewolves and vampires or orcs and centipedes in the same encounter. It's just going to be all orcs or one super orc or, you know, whatever the crap. So there's a little bit less variety in that sense. But in the overall scope of Four Against Darkness, there's plenty of monster variety. So I think that mostly what I'll be able to do is say, okay, and this is what this one rule set recommends. Like, you look in the D&D module that you're playing through, and you look at this monster encounter, and just based on the description and the flow of the adventure, is this supposed to be a pretty weak little monster, or like kind of a mini boss, or is this the boss of the dungeon? And based on kind of where you would thematically put them, which I think if you've been playing role-playing games for a while, you know what a kobold is compared to what a mummy is. And what role they are typically going to play in a dungeon crawl. Mummies are not going to be
you know, swarming you in cannon fodder and stuff like that. They're going to be at least something closer to a mini boss, or maybe if you're low level enough, the big boss. So I think that what I have to set aside is any desire to have it converted and all ready for me to go in advance of starting into the delve or the story. I think I'll need to embrace it as both a game and a creative exercise, where I'm maybe now and then creating a few monster stats along the way, or just kind of making calls along the way, which would be disastrous in some ways if I was playing this with anybody else. But when you're playing a solo game like this, really you're liberated so much in trying to experiment in this way. And so I think there's a pretty decent chance that I will explore this a bit. I do want to finish the crawl that I'm currently on, the dungeon that I'm currently in. But then maybe after that, I don't know. I did start flipping through one small module, and maybe it was just the way that one was laid out. And it was also late at night right before turning my light off, so I might have just been tired too. But just looking at it, I was like, this looks too complicated. So I don't know. But if I do, you know, dive into some kind of conversion from D&D to Four Against Darkness, I'll certainly update you guys. More than likely, when the time that I would most likely really try this out would be over Christmas vacation. So you may not hear anything from me on this until the new year. But yeah, if I do anything with it, I'll be sure to let you know. And that's my Geek Week. Next week, if God allows it, maybe a review of Matriarch and or Worm. These are two movies. I think they're both movies. I don't think either of them is a premiere. But they're both horror movies on Hulu. I still have a subscription that hasn't run out yet because of my Hellraiser review. And they actually come out the same day as Black Adam and the Amazon show, The Peripheral. But I decided, if anything, I was going to prioritize them. And there's other stuff coming out next week too, like Nope is coming to Redbox next week. Guillermo del Toro's Cabinet of Curiosities is coming to Netflix, and The Devil's Hour is a new kind of horror series premiere on Netflix. So those are possibilities as well. I am on track to have Essential Issues be on the show next week. I had mistakenly thought that I was planning it for this week, but I was actually just reading and making notes in my work schedule this week. Next week is when I'm actually recording it, editing it. I'll put it up on the YouTube channel and then also include it on the podcast. So that's almost a sure thing for next week. What I'm thinking right now I might do is review, if I have time for it, both Matriarch and Hulu, just to extract as much value as I can out of that Hulu subscription while I have it. And then bump potential reviews of Nope, Guillermo del Toro's thing, and Devil's Hour to the week after. And that way, at least these reviews, none of these things I'm reviewing is coming longer than a week after it initially released. That's kind of what I'm leaning toward right now, but we'll see. Until next time, though, please consider supporting the work of Christian Geek Central and Spirit Blade Productions and earning some fun rewards by becoming a Spirit Blade Insider of any subscription tier. Patreon.com/Spirit Blade Productions. Remember, from beyond, you can get it for $1. $1. Right, the $1 tier. I don't think there's tax added on, although sometimes when I look at patrons, there's numbers that are not a dollar, but I think that's because they're from overseas, and so some weird thing is going on there with exchange rates. I don't know. But it's called the $1 tier because it's supposed to be a dollar. So, and I think that's what I'm paying for a couple of Patreons that I'm subscribed to, for just the $1 tier. Anyway, but yeah, you can get all that good From Beyond content just in time to give you the Halloween spooky feelings. Just for a buck, patreon.com/Spirit Blade Productions. I'm also grateful for positive reviews of this podcast wherever you're finding it, and I want to say thank you for making time for this show. I hope you have a great week, and that you'll join me next time here on the Christian Geek Central podcast as we continue to geek out and seek the truth.
Christian Geek Central Podcast is a community-supported endeavor of Spirit Blade Productions. This podcast is produced by Peter Fremson with support from the Christian Geek Central community at ChristianGeekCentral.com. For information about the latest entertainment and resources from Spirit Blade Productions, visit SpiritBlade.com. Thank you for listening.
Okay. Dang it. Okay, I gotta make this quick. Where do we go from here after this? Dr. Fate. Spoiler, 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 spoiler. Go away if you don't want to hear it.
Here I go. Dr. Fate dies at the end, but he can be resurrected. And Kent Nelson in the comics started living in the helmet and coaching the new Dr. Fate at some point. So I think that could be a place they could go from here. You could also go back and do a World War II Justice Society with a younger actor playing Dr. Fate. I want a Justice Society movie with Green Lantern, you know, Alan Scott and Jay Garrick. But of course, I think we need that Hal Jordan movie probably first, just to build up that name brand a little bit for moviegoers. Henry Cavill in the scene at the end, in mid credits, is back as Superman. Hardly says anything except that, you know, we should talk, he says to Black Adam. But where does that potentially go? I don't think it's a fist fight. It's probably just something we would hear about later on as well. I tried to reason with him, didn't work out, you know, or maybe it worked for now. But it's less important than Henry Cavill on a meta level being back and establishing that, yes, he is still Superman in this DC universe. And I think that's great. There's more that I could probably say on there. Actually, on the podcast, was it this week or last week? I can't remember when I recorded it. But recently, that's something on the podcast that's come up, and I think I share some thoughts there. Amanda Waller being the connective tissue, maybe, between the Justice Society and Black Adam, and I think that's kind of a way that we could kind of, like, connect elements of the DC Universe together is with Amanda Waller. I think there is another Suicide Squad movie coming, so I think that she could serve as a dude with eye patch in the Marvel movies. Nick Fury. Yeah, she could be the Nick Fury for the DC Universe. A lot really depends on the outcome of the Flash movie coming up, which is almost certainly going to reset continuity to some degree. I'm guessing that Black Adam will be the villain in a third Shazam movie. It's been confirmed, I believe, that he's not in the upcoming one, but it makes a ton of sense that he would be the villain in the third, presumably final, you know, Shazam movie in the trilogy, I assume. I think they're going to plan on doing more. Those kids are getting old. But really, yeah, there's so much up in the air right now with power currently changing hands at Warner Brothers. I would say a director's cut release of this movie would indicate where DC is heading. If, like, whoever was in charge that made this movie the way it is now out and they hurry, start working right now on a director's cut, because Hamada, the big guy that left, just left like this week or something. So I think if we get a director's cut of this, that could maybe help us speculate as to what's coming in the future, at least in terms of tone. I don't know. But definitely, I think we got to keep watch on that Flash movie. I think that is their most valuable course correction point, pivot point, whatever you want to call it. That is the potential, and they have to see that to establish what the DCU is going to be going forward. Hopefully, it's not going to be more like this. But anyway, those are all my thoughts for now. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.